I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order, and I would like to open a public hearing on SCR 10 in memory of Dr. Robert Bacon. Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, SCR 10 in memoriam, Dr. Robert Bacon. Bacon, born 1918 and passed away January of 09. Bacon.
With that, I'd like to call Senator Johnson and Representative Boone to the dais. Or to the...
Morning,
did Jeff. I call it dais?
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, for the record. Deborah Boone, mm-hmm. House District 32. And I was asked to bring this before you, and as were several other members of the legislature, to honor Dr. Bacon. He's a representative, or he's a constituent of Senator Johnson and mine, living in Gearhart, and used to teach at the medical school. His family, long renowned in our district for their interest in education, enrichment for medical education. He was an anatomy professor at OHSU. I think he actually was a professor of Dr. Kitzhaber, former governor of our state. And as much as I knew who he was, I've met him a couple of times, but didn't know him well personally, but I do know that everyone in our area respected and, is now grieving his death. And so this seems a fitting way to memorialize his in his honor, and we hope that you give this your favorable consideration.
Thanks, Representative Boone.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Betsy Johnson. I am the senator from District 16 that includes Gearhart, Dr. Bacon's home. His death at nearly 91 ended a life well lived. He was a scholar, an extraordinary teacher, a conservationist, largely credited with his work on the beach bill, a vintner, an engaged citizen of Gearhart, a much beloved figure, as Representative Boone has said. I think it's completely appropriate that we extend our condolences to his family and that we memorialize this great Oregonian.
Thank you. Senator Bate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I never knew this gentleman, and he's not in my district. But I got several phone calls from constituents in my district about this man, and it piqued my curiosity. Who is this person on the coast that I didn't know, but who obviously had a huge impact? And as we researched it more, we found out, and I called Senator Johnson and Representative Boone, I didn't call, I'm sorry. But I called Senator Johnson about this, and we found out the history of this incredible man who had done so much to open up our beaches many years ago. And it always reminds me when I find stories like this that we truly stand on the shoulders of giants. Things we take for granted, our open beaches, were pioneered and done by people we've almost forgotten now. People who did a great job 20, 30 years ago, put huge amounts of time, effort into these things, and after the fact is accomplished, we have a tendency to forget them. So for that reason, I was happy to co-sponsor this bill. I think it's a fine memorial to a wonderful man. I would also offer that when you go through medical school, you have multiple professors in physiology, biochemistry, and others. There's always one you remember, and it's always the same one. It's your anatomy professor. These guys are killers, okay? They're tough teachers, but when you're all through with it, they're the ones you respect the most and have the highest regard for, because they taught you about the human body, which you really needed to know. And he was an anatomy professor who was so well-loved by his students that they have a memorial for him also in an endowment. I think it speaks a lot about a man who, at the age of 91, when he passes away, and when we started this bill, he had not passed away yet, has this kind of community support and support from his former students. So I'm very happy to be doing this with my colleagues from the coast.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else to testify? All right. Thank you. We'll close. Ellen Lowe wants to testify.
Thank you. Chair Laurie Monis Anderson and members of the committee, it seems like I just left some of you. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today as an individual whose life was very much touched by Dr. Bacon. Among other things, I remember that 1951 and 1952, one of those things I did to make a little money during my college years was mentor a number of individuals who became Oregon's coaches and school superintendents. So you know what group of folks I was mentoring in Oregon history. And at that time, we took for granted that the fact that the beach had been declared a highway way back when, at the beginning of the last century, that was all we needed. And you know, it wasn't, because we began to see in the 50s and 60s some real encroachment on what we considered our commons. And so it was because of the leadership of Dr. Bacon and a number of others that we were able really to now say the Oregon Beach is our commons. And it was touched my life because I was on the first Coastal Commission, and we never would have been able to have done the things that we did if we had not had the beach bill as our basis. Also, Dr. Bacon touched my family's life because there was a young Stanford grad who entered the medical school back in the 50s, my little brother. And somehow he ended up having Dr. Bacon as his major prof. And he was talked into taking an extra year and getting his master's degree as well as his doctorate. And in California, my brother is known in the legislature for making appearances like his sister sometimes does here. And his life was so touched by Dr. Bacon. Dr. Bacon was not only his mentor, his major prof in medical school, he remained his close friend for over 50 years. And so I often think of someone where we sometimes separate our lives into dealing with human services and with the environment. Dr. Bacon made that bridge, and he did not set man apart. And so I'm so pleased you're honoring him, and I'll share this with my brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you very much. Any further discussion? All right, with that, I'll close the public hearing on SCR 10. And I'll open, I'm not sure I need to do this. Colleagues, last night we opened a work session on 421, 422, and 427. We're still waiting for amendments, so we are going to carry them over till Thursday. So hopefully we will have amendments on Thursday. And I forgot the work session. Okay. Open a work session on SCR 10.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move SCR 10 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves SCR 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Johnson, would you like to carry?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, I'll close the work session on SCR 10. Now I'll talk about the bills that we work session yesterday, but we were not able to pass out. And so hopefully we'll just carry them on over to Thursday. And colleagues, we will be meeting at what time on Thursday? We'll meet at 8 in the morning, and then we have because we have so many bills, we will be meeting in the evening. Is it what time?
Six.
Six o'clock. Do you know what hearing room?
I don't know what room.
We don't know what room, so.
At that time of night, any room you want, I would think.
Yeah.
So.
Spaghetti Factory.
Yeah, we can do that.
That's right. All right. So I don't need. Do I need to open a work session to carry him over?
Just carry him over.
Just carry him over.
Make the announcement.
Yeah, let's just do that. All right, and unfortunately, Senate Bill 316. We don't have the fiscal, so. But do we have the amendment?
No.
And we don't have the amendment. So with that, we will. That's why we're having an evening meeting.
Okay.
So we will carry over Senate Bill 316. With that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 117. And is Patrick or Lisa here? If not, I'm... Okay.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 117 exempts dental clinics at certain institutions of higher education from requirement to have license to practice dentistry. This committee heard this bill about a month ago. There have been a couple of amendments, and I understand the work group has met last Thursday, and will update you on their progress.
It's Jesse Cornett and...
For the record, Patrick Brotz, I'm the Executive
Patrick,
Director
yes.
of the Board of Dentistry.
Okay. Whoever.
For the record, Jesse Cornett, I'm the Government Relations Director for Portland State University. I want to thank the committee for bringing this bill up again. Since the last session, we've had numerous conversations with Patrick and members of the dental community who are interested in this piece of legislation. I believe you may be getting testimony today from one of those folks. There is a belief amongst some within the dental community that PSU and other universities can continue to operate their dental clinics with modifications without needing to create a new exemption. We're not sure that's the case. We have our certified smart people in this area actually working on this and planning to meet again with members of the dental community soon. For time's sake, we hope that the committee will move this bill and we'll continue the conversations. If we're able to confirm that we don't actually need the legislation, we don't intend to pursue it in the House. And I just really want to thank Patrick and others in the dental community that have been working really closely with us to make sure that the over 3,000 students here at Portland State who receive dental services through the clinic aren't left without. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, the Board of Dentistry has been working with the
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Patrick Brotz, the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry, for the record. We have been working with universities and the various dental stakeholders, and there appears to be the opposition that existed at one point doesn't exist now. There still are some conversations going forward, as Jesse alluded to, but we hope that the committee will pass this bill out to the Senate so that at least we know that if those conversations don't come to fruition, that we will have this, which will correct the problem that exists.
Okay. Any other questions? Doug, do you want to come forward or not?
Some confusion.
Morning. Chair Mo Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of Willamette Dental Group. Steve Petrozelli was unable to make it this morning, so I've submitted some written testimony. Steve was part of the work group last week that met with Jesse and Patrick and others. I think the position, Willamette's position, can in brief be stated that we don't think the legislation is needed. We do think that PSU and other universities can operate under the law just like Willamette Dental does, and we are willing to help them figure out a way to make that work. We understand that because of the timing of the session, they want to move this bill forward, and we're not going to try to oppose that. I think what for me was probably most interesting, we had an hour-long meeting and conference call last week talking about this bill and dental ownership, and not once did the issue of the importance of a dentist owning a clinic surface. For some reason, in previous sessions, that's been important for patient safety. Now, apparently, it is not, at least in this case. So from our perspective, it continues to raise questions about the value of the dental ownership law when we continue to add exception after exception to who can own a dental practice. So our hope is that, if nothing else, we end up during the interim sitting down with the board and other dental practices to see if we can find a way to bring the dental ownership statute into the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, I am very interested in pursuing the non-dentist ownership idea and would love to work with the Board of Dentistry and other interested parties during the interim on this issue.
Don't look at me.
It's been very contentious, and we keep coming forward because the community is changing, and we don't require nurse practitioners to own their clinics and docs to own their clinics, and because we're expanding such, maybe this is the opportune time to look at that piece of statute. All right, yes.
Madam Chair, I'm just confused. We're being asked, on one hand, we don't think this is necessary, but we're not sure, so we're being asked to move it in case it is necessary. I don't understand why we can't get a read on whether it's necessary. I clearly I don't want to see a negative impact on the universities, but I'm also not comfortable moving a bill that we might need or might not and might allow to die. I just don't understand why we can't get a definitive legal opinion in a short time frame on this.
Chair Monta Sanderson, Senator Cruz, Jesse from Portland State. When we first pursued this bill, we didn't reach out to the dental community as broadly as could have been done to really delve into the issues, because we were already operating a dental clinic under the health clinic exception. We saw this bill as being not very contentious, that it would simply be a housekeeping type bill. Obviously, we've learned that that's not the case. Had we been looking at those questions in August, we would have a little bit more of a definitive answer. Because of the nature of the bill and the Dental Practices Act, those conversations really got started in earnest just a couple of weeks ago, and I think that we'll have a really firm answer whether it will happen in advance of the deadline to move bills out of a committee. I don't know.
If I might follow up to Senator Cruz, I think the issue isn't whether legally they can figure out a way to do it, because we know they can do it legally because we do it. The issue is, do they have to set up management agreements to make that work? The dentists who currently work in their clinics would have to own the practice. You have to set up a whole different legal structure, and it affects how they're compensated. It affects their benefits. It's a change, and it's really a question of, is that a change they want to do, and do they see that as a huge obstacle or not see that as a huge obstacle? And we've talked about it in broad terms, and I think the game plan is to sit down with their attorneys and our management experts and help them better understand exactly how we have to structure the practice to make it legal within the current law, and then they have to just make a decision about whether that works for them.
Do you want to follow up? I
agree with the chair that there's a bigger issue here that probably should be addressed, and I support her efforts from 10 feet behind her in that. And but I guess one of the things we're hearing is that it's current practice, and we're thinking it's legal for them to do what they're currently doing. I don't know why we can't.
No. Chair Anderson, it's not currently legal. Under the law, only a dentist or the groups that are listed in this law can own a dental practice act. What Mr. Barber's talking about is the model that Willamette has, and let's use KSU as an example. Is it six dentists you have? They would have to own the practice. So that means they got to get together and they got to form some type of a corporation or some type of an entity. They got to find out about the union contracts that they have for the other employees that are already there. They would then offer their services back to PSU. That may not be able to be done between now and April 17th when you have to move bills forward. And so, once again, they'd be in violation of the law. And that's why we wanted to come forward today to say that the bill needs to continue to move forward. If PSU, as well as the other institutions, decide that they want to use, and I'll call it the Willamette model, but it's not just a Willamette model, they can do that under the existing law, but we're not sure it can be put together that fast.
And I think avoiding any kind of possible litigation is extremely important in this matter, because we are talking about market share also. And so I am concerned that I'm concerned that we have to do this, because I think it's ridiculous to keep exempting everybody except for the Willamette Dental Group people. And so that's why I really think that we need to, in the interim, look at that with the Board of Dentistry and see if there's any compromise whatsoever on changing that statute. All right. Yes, Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I agree with the good senator from Roseburg. This is going to be a continuing problem, and We got caught in it once before. We're caught in it again here now. The dental board has one position. Their association apparently has another from my previous history with this group. The dental board actually brought legislation forward to change the law and bring it basically into the 21st century or 22nd century, whichever we're in now. And the dental association then block the bill, and we're going to run into the same thing here. So we'll make another exemption, and we really won't resolve this issue. I'm afraid, and I agree, this bill probably needs to go forward. I'm afraid that they could be facing a lawsuit from a dentist saying you're operating illegally. And we ran this problem. We were worried about widows of dentists operating illegally. Her husband dies suddenly, or in this day and age, the woman is the dentist. She dies. The husband steps in, hires a dentist to keep the practice going until they can sell the practice, and that's illegal. Yeah. But it happens. And there are other. I'm sure there's other examples of this. I mean, it cries out for a change, but my experience has been is that the dental association, not the board, the association has blocked this every time we brought this up, allowing a non-dentist to own a practice. And I'm not sure if we ever resolve it other than keeping exempting people out all the time.
Well, from conversations that I've had, the association is getting a lot of younger dentists on board, which may change the tone of this association. I don't know if that's true, but...
Actually, Madam Chair, I came to the state of Oregon just at the time that that legislation had gone forward, and actually was the younger dentist that prevented it from happening. The board and the association had reached an agreement on minority ownership, and then at their House of Delegates, one of the student dentists got up and said they didn't like the idea, and they changed the whole delegation to support them. So I don't know. Maybe now, 6 years later, there is a change, but at least at that time, that was the issue that prevented it from happening. And like I said, I came in the tail end of it after it happened. So.
Well,
I'd support pushing this on through. Just we've got to give them some cover.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close the. Unless there's anyone else to testify, I'm closing the public hearing on SCR. Senate Bill 117, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 117. And we don't have any. Wait, I don't have a fiscal in here.
Madam Chair, we have a.
Yes, I do.
-2 amendments that need to be acted on, and we also have a revenue and a fiscal on -2. So we do have the. necessary documentation.
I don't have a copy of the dash twos for some reason.
I do.
I don't.
Okay. You don't need that. Okay.
Okay. Oh, Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 117 reluctantly.
And do we have a fiscal?
Yes, we do.
On the dash twos?
On the dash two. Revenue and a fiscal on the dash two.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 117. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 117 as amended by the dash two amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendations.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 117 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes. Well, Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize there's a longstanding issue here, but I'm not sure that it's the appropriate role of the legislature to be in the business of dividing markets and managing market share. I think fundamentally that's a wrong place to be. I'll vote for this bill because it's probably needed from a clinical education standpoint, but I think our role is more appropriately focused on quality, patient safety, and standards, and not divisions of markets. So
I appreciate your comments, Senator Morris. Senator, further, yes, Senator. Yeah.
I really do not like sending unfinished products out of committee, mm-hmm. although occasionally we are forced by time to do that. I do think that I would like for us to come to a resolution in the interim on this issue, put it to bed for good, because Senator Morris is right. This is not the sort of stuff we should be involved in. And I think the system is flawed and needs to be fixed, and so we don't keep revisiting this issue every few years. So.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Well, the proponents of the bill were concerned about the time constraint in the Senate side, but there will be some opportunities on the House side to work this bill. There could be some kind of an agreement before the final passage.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, just so it's on the record that we know we're sending a work in progress to the House so that they're fully aware that we expect them to take it up and potentially offer additional amendments. So.
I agree. So, Mr. Shook, would you put that in the background or the comments on the summary sheet?
Yes.
to the House? That would be helpful. All right, the clerk. Oh, yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Others have spoken already, and I'm not going to take a lot of time. I think there is obviously a larger problem here, and because of time constraints, we're not going to deal with this bill the way we should. I frankly would like to see a bill that came out of the Senate that said ownership, minority ownership by a non-dentist is appropriate. Clear the decks, yeah. Open it up, and get it done. And, you know, face a reality situation and all these exemptions to go away. If the House, because of time constraints, would like to take that issue up, I would specifically ask them to do so. Because that's what needs to be done here. It just passed the time it should be done. This is no longer 1886. Corporations own these, whether it's medical or dental, and it's time for the dentists to step up and join the real world. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I agree totally, and that's why we will have a work session. So, Patrick, you heard the words of the committee, and if you could prepare your colleagues of what we would love to work out in the interim, that would be awesome.
The future tsunami.
All right, the future tsunami. Well, maybe not. Okay. With that, I'll close the work session. Yes. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Morrison.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monica
Anderson. Aye.
This should be wide open.
Who would like to carry this?
Not me.
I'll carry it.
Madam Chair, I will.
Okay.
I want to get on the record.
That would be really good.
I want to get on the record what the issue behind this is and get it on the record. And I'll probably actually offer an amendment on the other side for the House to. I mean, the relating clause and relating to dentistry, it's wide open.
Yeah. But we can do anything we want to the dentist under this bill.
Okay, so Senator Bates will carry this, and good motion call. Is carried. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 117. And for those who are here for Senate Bill 529, we were going to have a work session, but we don't have the fiscal. Correct, Mr. Shook?
Right, we do have to, you want to accept the one amendments?
We could accept the one amendment if we wanted to do that. So, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 529. Mr. Shook.
Senate Bill, Madam Chair, 529 directs Department of Human Resources to establish a position to act as a liaison between the department and the communities that may become sites of transitional housing facilities. We heard this bill about a month ago. There have subsequent been -1 amendments, which are, I would consider, minor tweaking, but you may ask a representative to come up and explain them.
Okay. Who is here to talk on Senate Bill 529? I don't have the witness registration.
Mary Jane. Okay.
Yeah.
Or Ellen.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Jane Ellen Whiteance with Addictions and Mental Health Division, the Governmental Affairs Manager. And the -1 amendment basically expand the scope of this new liaison position from just focusing on facilities serving people under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board to all of the housing development that we are doing. And it directly follows Richard Harris's direction to staff at Addictions and Mental Health Division to assess and develop what he calls right-sizing the system as we move forward and really looking at how much development we need to do for which types of populations that we're serving and where do we need to develop those types of housing.
All right. Is there any discussion on the amendment? We're in work session. Do I have a motion? Or should we just wait until we get the fiscal and give you more time to look at it? This is a bill that that Jackie Winters and Peter Courtney brought forward to us, really wanting to set up a giving more direction to the department in setting up transitional housing.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I just want to make it absolutely clear that this amendment expands beyond just PSRB to all persons. So this isn't just release. This isn't just release from from the state hospital. This is community-based mental health. This is the whole.
So we may want to just wait for the fiscal also.
I mean, as far as citing.
I can answer that if you'd like. Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz, the intent really is we're not sure how much more development we're going to need, and having a dedicated staff person working with liaisoning with the community, which is a process that Addictions and Mental Health Division has already started over the last couple, probably about 6 months ago, is developing a new process working with communities before we decide to place a facility, and working then with the local nonprofits who actually find the location and build the site and run the site. So really what the idea was is if we have this just dedicated to developing PSRB facilities, we could have someone sitting around, to be blunt, twiddling their thumbs. So we thought that really expanding this to our entire development process and having an interactive, engaged process with local communities about all of our mental health facilities is an important step.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think what I like about the amendment is it's more of a bottom-up approach to dealing with siting rather. I mean, the PSRB issue is clear and distinct and needs to be dealt with, but we also need to have the bottom-up approach, and that's why I like the amendment. So,
yes, Senator Bates and then Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I'd like to move the bill. I think it's worthwhile moving, and the amendments are really important. As I thought about them when I saw them come through, I realized how important they are. Right now we have a mental health system that's fragmented. We're trying to transform that. We're trying to do wraparound services. We want complete systems in our counties or in our regions. So when someone goes to the emergency room, as an example, with a mental health issue, they have someplace to go when they leave that emergency room. That means you have to have housing for them. We want to have non-forensic patients at the mental health hospital, say, have a place to go to in their local communities. These are not forensic patients that would be under PSRB, but patients who are there for a civil commitment. And this allows them to have a place to go to. The difficulty with not in my backyard has been very real, and not just for patients who have had commitments because of committing a crime, but even for others. And this individual would be very important to go in communities and to talk to those community members and let them understand what really is being proposed and what might be happening in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to happen, not only from the point of view of people coming out of the mental health hospital, but for local people that are cycling in and out of hospitals. We want to stop that cycling. So I appreciate the amendments. They're significant. They speak to how we're trying to transform the system. So for those reasons, I'd like to see this move forward. Thank you.
Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, how does this bill relate to the work that is emerging out of the House? That's a follow-up to the work group that was formed on this siting issue. Is this a duplication of anything that's coming out of that effort on the House side, or is this standing alone?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, actually, we look at this as a companion bill. This really directs that DHS have a dedicated staff person on board in the division working on this issue of liaison with communities. House Bill 2052, which is, I think, on its way over or has been sent over from the House, actually mandates that we include in that process that this individual would do is to go to the local plan, local Public Safety Coordinating Councils. I say the acronym too much and I forget the real words, but so that basically tells us who to go to. This sets up the person who will do that, and Addictions and Mental Health Division has a broader process that we are beginning to develop, where it includes meeting with the sheriff's, local law enforcement, the DA, the mayor's, local other elected officials, the county commissioners, working with neighborhood associations, really proactively engaging. And one of the reasons, I'm sorry that you don't have the fiscal, because there is a zero fiscal on both the original bill and the amendment, because we've already dedicated resources to this. And what we did ask is that this committee and Ways and Means give us the actual position authority. We've carved out money to have someone on staff at the moment, and we'd like to be able to continue that into the 2009-11 biennium. But there's no actual fiscal, because we've carved this money out of other parts of our budget.
Madam Chair, I would direct you to the last page of your packet. It is a fiscal on 529 original, so the amendments do not change that, and the last paragraph reinforces what Jane Allen mentioned. The department appointed a staff person a while back specifically to be responsible to work full-time on this. The passage of Senate Bill 529 would codify their current DHS practice. The note from fiscal was that the bill may require budgetary action to establish position, but the dollars are currently there and someone is currently working in that position.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
The person working on it is Bob Repine, who is visiting the city of Springfield, which is my city. And I had a discussion with Bob, and the city had bad experiences before with this type of a program, but I think we, meaning the city of Springfield, will probably work with Bob to establish a facility which has been identified and work with the neighborhood group. And it'll be 12 beds, about half of them civil commitments and the other half forensics. And it is a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Repine has a lot of experience working with local communities, and I think we'll do a great job. I think it's a good idea to extend that position. Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, I want to move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 529 because I think it's absolutely key and important that we do that. So.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 529.
It's just the original.
And we have not talked with the proponents, chief sponsors of the bill, but we have to wait for the fiscal anyway, even though you have said that it isn't, but we need to have that, and we will make sure I confirm that this is in agreement with Senator Winters and Senator Courtney. Okay. All right. Is there any discussion on the -1 amendments? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 529, and we will carry over 529 to Thursday's meeting because we should have the fiscal on there, and then we can get this
one to the floor. Doing the morning or the evening, we probably
yeah, we'll be doing it. Morning and evening. So we've closed the work session on Senate Bill 529. And we have to carry over Senate Bill 460. We don't have the amendment.
Yes, we do.
Oh, we do have the amendment.
Hot off the press, Madam Chair.
Oh, hot off the press as of
Yes. Senate Bill 460 directs the Department of Human Services to establish registry and advisory committees related to birth anomalies and adverse pregnancy outcomes. Madam Chair, this bill was heard a couple of weeks ago. We do have a fiscal, and we do have an amendment, and I think the amendment impacts the fiscal dramatically. And there may be representatives here can address the amendments.
Okay. Joanne, do you want to talk about the amendments or do you want to wait until you have seen the amendments? Yeah. Okay. Since the amendments just came out, colleagues, I want to carry over Senate Bill 460 to Thursday so that the proponents of the bill can look at the amendments to make sure that that is what indeed we intended for them to say. Did I open up? I didn't open.
You did, but
okay. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 460, and Ms. Rhoda, will you look to make sure that the amendments are all right? Then, so we close the Senate Bill 460, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 18. Tom Holt. 60.
How about 575?
They wanted to be last, so we will do that last.
Okay.
Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated, which is a managed care organization under the Oregon Health Plan. I'm also the legislative chair for the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. And speaking now for all of the health plans in the Oregon Health Plan who are on this bill. This bill started, this legislation started in 2003 and was modified in the 2007 legislation. There was a sunset put on the legislation to see how it would work. The bill essentially pulls the sunset provision off of the legislation. We had a work group way early in 2008. Was called by DMAP. Jim Edge convened the meeting. The participants were the members of the Oregon Health Plan, the managed care organizations, and hospital, mostly hospital CFOs that came to that meeting. The question was asked by DMAP, how is the current language working? The answer from all the participants was it was working well. We had scheduled a two-hour meeting. It took 20 minutes, which is quite unusual for things like this, and it was agreed that we would move forward with the current language as the bill was written. The only thing that has come up since then with the language is the 80% number, and the 80% number was fixed in the bill in 07, and the reason why that was fixed was because that was the level at which the legislature was funding the hospitals into the premiums for the managed care organizations. What we have proposed and has been signed off by the hospitals was the changing of that language so that it is a dynamic number that moves with wherever the legislature is funding the premium. So if the legislature moves the funding to 90%, then the amount goes up. If they fund it at 72%, the amount goes down. Again, so neither side is disadvantaged. We have given that language to LC. Unfortunately, they haven't come out with it yet.
Why do we need the bill then if it's just going to fluctuate with what the...
Well, what we need is we need a target for the non-contracted amount, and that's why we need the bill. But the fluctuating amount is needed because one side or the other gets disadvantaged if the legislature changes the funding level and it doesn't move. If it goes up, then the hospitals are disadvantaged. If the funding goes down, then the plans are disadvantaged. So we want to keep the level playing field that we agreed to in the 07 language.
Questions? Okay.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mr. Hetherington is correct in this respect, and the bill reflects some agreements that were made and piloted out of the last session, and I think all parties have agreed that it's worked reasonably well, at least anecdotally. What we hear from our members that this has been beneficial in terms of making sure that more of the rural hospitals in particular are operating under a contract. There are some other agreements not reflected in the statute that have been put into contract and into rule that we would like to have all in one place in the statute. And specifically, there's some language in the contracts that we've identified that calls for meeting certain adequacy requirements of 85% of the claims paid as well as the dollars paid be under contract, so and showing good faith on both sides of the hospital and the plan that they are actually trying to get to a contract if they're not meeting those numbers. The other area that is in, and it's in rule, has to do with the reimbursement rate, and I think there's been an honest misunderstanding or miscommunication about where we are on that issue at this particular point. We do support the idea of having 80% in the statute as it is now in the rule. We had some discussion about potentially having a conceptual idea of having that go up and down with the budget, but we had not formally checked off on that, and I apologize for there being a misunderstanding about that. But we, I think, are all wanting to come to some agreements here fairly rapidly and get something drafted and back before you as soon as possible. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Let's ask Kevin Earls also to come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I just wanted to also...
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Kevin Earls. With the Oregon Hospital Association. I also wanted to communicate that it is our desire to continue with the agreement that we were able to reach with the managed care plans last session. We did put a pilot program into place, and it was more than about payment. It was also about network adequacy. And it, for the first time in this agreement, required that health plans report claims that were paid that weren't pursuant to a contract to DHS, so that DHS could quickly and easily see if there were holes in the network that a plan had for particular kinds of providers. So it provided a level of kind of network adequacy assurance for people in the Medicaid program that has been in place for people with commercial insurance for many years in Oregon. And that provision, as well as the payment provision, were part of this agreement. As Mr. Holt said, those components of the agreement that we reached last session happen to be somewhat scattered. One piece is in rule, another piece is in statute, and a third piece is in contract. And because the parties that helped reach that agreement are the only ones that kind of understand how those things work together, we simply wanted to put all three pieces in the same place. And so that's what our effort is to do in the bill. It doesn't impose anything new that the plans aren't today subject to and have agreed to. And one final thing is, because this is a demonstration project till now, there is a report that comes out from the agency about the claims that were paid pursuant to, or in the absence of a contract. And that first report has not yet been issued. So while we know anecdotally that this seems to be working well for both sides, that's all the information that we have at this point. And in talking with the agency, my understanding is that they've prepared a draft and the numbers look good. But again, that's something that we haven't seen yet. So just in closing, all this is attempting to do is to put the three pieces of an agreement in one spot so that future legislators and lawmakers are able to see the context of the agreement.
Mr. Hetherington, do you want to respond?
Yes, a couple of things. This is not a demonstration. This has been going on now for 6 years. The change that happened in 07 was to change the calculation of what we paid non-contracted hospitals, because the original formula was so unwieldy and so indeterminate that from year to year we didn't know what that amount was going to be on the MCO side. When we went through this in 07, there was a determination that certain things needed to be put in the law and certain things would be put into rule or contract. And, you know, as a group, because of the nature of the rules and the contracts, we're opposed to putting this language into the law. I mean, if you're going to do that, take the entire contract we have to sign or all the OARs. That's why you have OARs. You don't put them into law. There are certain considerations that DHS has. It gives them the flexibility to change the rules if they need to. And this whole issue about network adequacy has been around since time immemorial. There has never been any numbers to show that there isn't network adequacy, and frankly, it's a red herring. We object to it, primarily because it came up within the last 3 days. And we've been talking about this for a year and a half.
Okay. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I always enjoy it when there's consensus before us. It's lovely to see. Okay. Almost late. It's not this case. There's a lot of discussions about this going on. It's a very complex situation. I think there's other discussions outside this room concerning provider taxes and other issues that might relate to this. I think this is a bill that's also still waiting for an amendment, is from what I understand. And I think we need to wait for those and discuss those when they come before us. This has been going on as long as I've been here. I was part of the 03 and 07 discussions. This was an attempt to sort of lay out a groundwork for managed care plans and hospitals to come together and have negotiations. And those negotiations vary from hospital to hospital, region to region. There are hospitals that form risk pools with the MCOs, and some that don't. There's par and non-par, participating hospitals, non-participating hospitals, and I think if we get too deeply involved in this and don't leave some flexibility for the department and the hospitals and the managed care plans to sit down and work those out, we could find ourselves having some unintended consequences. So I've got asbestos gloves on for this one right now. I'm going to watch it very carefully and take my time before I make up my mind about any votes in this one.
I would say to the committee, we're, our primary concern is that we get the bill out with the calculation in it, because if the bill sunsets, we go back to a formula that actually had us prior to 07 paying about 125% of Medicare when we were funded at 80% of Medicare. And it's just the way the formula read. So it's very important that we have that, change that is in the 07 bill go forward.
Now, do you have amendments?
Well, actually, if we left the bill strictly as it was, as it is and took out the sunset, we'd be set at 80%. Like I said, if you leave it there, if the legislature funds at 72%, the plans are disadvantaged. If the legislature funds the hospitals in our rates at 100%, then the hospitals are disadvantaged. And the amendment we have floats it to wherever the legislature funds the premium.
And you are in favor of that?
And we are in favor of that, because it does leave the playing field even for both sides that we agreed to in 07.
And the hospitals are in favor of that?
Madam Chair, we have not agreed to that.
Okay, so we will take that into consideration when we get the amendment. We will make a policy decision. If you guys can't get to consensus, then we here will make that decision. All righty. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18. Is that what we were hearing?
18.
And we'll open our final bill for the day, Senate Bill 575. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 575 allows physician assistants, and it is the Physician Assistant Day at the Capitol today, to authorize commitment of person who is mentally ill.
And Senator Morissette wants to start us off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Madam Chair, this is in committee. This I see as a very important rural health bill that would allow physician assistants to do something that they are, I shouldn't say already doing, but near doing, under the guidance of a physician. They do have to get by the Board of Medical Examiners. If we pass this bill, they have to go to the Board of Medical Examiners and get their permission to do this. And it has to do with allowing them to commit the commitment of persons, a person who is mentally ill. And there are a lot of related things that they're already doing. Now, I'm not going to get into any detail on this, because you have a room full of physician assistants, many of them from rural Oregon, who are here to testify. So I will end with that, and hopefully,
Okay, I'll call Marshall Koba up, and he will let us know who to start the
show. And then
the show.
I will, in a moment.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, here today in support of Senate Bill 575. We have drafted some Dash 1 amendments to the bills, which we will discuss shortly. I want to thank Senator Morissette for his support. We're handing out a packet which has a lot of good demographic information and some recent articles and some other data on PAs in Oregon and nationally, and we can talk about that if you like. Thank you for the public hearing on the bill today. Today, as was mentioned, is Physician Assistant Day at the Capitol. I'm pleased to have several practicing PAs in the audience, as well as several PA students, and we invite you to drop by our information kiosk in the Galleria following the hearing. Oregon currently has 853 practicing PAs, many of whom have been trained at the two PA programs in Oregon, one at OHSU and the other at Pacific University in Forest Grove. Both graduate about 30 highly qualified PAs per year after a rigorous two-year program. In addition, the entrance into the program is very highly sought after, with more than 600 applicants for each class at each school annually. PAs are trained in the medical model in rigorous educational programs in university and academic healthcare settings. The curriculum emphasizes the basic sciences, clinical medicine, and behavioral medicine necessary to evaluate and manage common medical conditions. Applicants must have previous college coursework as well as direct patient care experience. The majority of PA programs confer a master's degree on completion of a 24 to 26-month intensive program. To Senate Bill 7575, it allows PAs to instigate or to participate in a two-physician hold for mentally ill patients who are a danger to themselves or to others. The Dash 1 amendments highlight Section 7 in the bill, which outlines the process for the two-physician hold. The two-physician hold is a very important process for our members who are often the first and in some cases the only contact with a mentally ill patient. We believe this will be a positive addition to patient care in Oregon and help protect patients and the public. With me today at the dais is Kate Grace. Kate is a 12-year practicing PA from Baker City and rural Oregon. And I'll turn it over to and the current president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Thank you.
Kate is from Halfway. And I said, Halfway from where?
From where?
She said, between heaven and Hell's Canyon.
Which, thank you very much for the committee to letting us speak today. It's very nice that it's also PA Day at the Capitol. I am from Halfway, Oregon, and for those of you that know, Halfway is not just rural, it's frontier. We are 56 miles.
And from introduce yourself.
I am Catherine Grace. I am the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. I have been a PA in Oregon for 12 years. 10 and a half of that, I was the sole on-site provider in Halfway, Oregon, for cradle to grave. Now, for the last 18 months, I've been working with Dr. Charles Hoffman in Baker City, Oregon. This is a bill that is very near and dear to my heart. As you are aware, or maybe not be aware, Oregon has one of the highest suicide and mental health rates in the nation. Baker County has the highest in the state of Oregon. For myself, not being able to initiate mental health holds has impacted some of our people in rural America. We are 56 miles from Baker City, which is the nearest hospital. The two things I will tell you about today, one was a young lady that had a psychiatric meltdown, and I was unable to convince an ER doctor in Baker City that this woman, young woman, needed to be held. And I finally got a doctor in Idaho that she needed to be held. But because we got her to Idaho, which is across the line, which is a little interesting doing, but because there was not two people and a physician agreeing in Oregon, she was let go. And she wasn't let go to anyone. She was let go to the street. She consequently completed her suicide. That is not the only one we've had. We seem to go in cycles. If you know rural Oregon, you know that there is a high incidence of alcoholism. There is a high incidence of drugs. And as the as people are losing their jobs and as people are losing their health care, and as Senator Bates pointed out, our mental health care in the state of Oregon is extremely fragile. I had another young man that was brought in 2 o'clock in the morning to the clinic in Halfway, and he was drunk, he was off his meds, he was bipolar. He I can't do anything legally to admit these people or to hold them. And the sheriff's deputy that was there and later the assistant DA that came out, this was an all-night process, says, you know, we can't take your say-so. Subsequently, he was let go that evening. Not only did he stab somebody, he also tried to stab himself. He later escaped Oregon and went to Alaska. Alaska got him the help he needed. But that's just two, and I'm just one person. And, I mean, there's a long list, and there's other people that will testify today. Being able to assist mental health in Oregon that is just getting worse because of the financial climates, because of loss of jobs, loss of insurances. Even if that was not happening today, how we practice in rural Oregon is impacted by the fact that we can't assist our mental health patients. Dave Condon, who worked for Dave Jones, who worked in Condon for 25 years, asked that I pass this story on to you. He just recently retired in Condon, and as you know, Condon's in the wheat country. Condon Fossil sees a lot of rural people. Just before he retired last year, it's about 6 months ago, he was asked to do a mental health hold on a patient that was a detriment to himself. And they had called, the people in Fossil were not there. And Dave says, I cannot do this. And he was told, Fossil does it all the time. Fossil's not allowed to do that, not legally. And he had to decline to stay within the statutes to do it legally. So is it being done? Possibly. Should it be being done? Yes. And that's what I ask you to consider. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Scott Beyer, and I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 575. Let me give you a little bit of a history about why we're here today. As physician assistants, we are teamed with the physician as a dependent practitioner. And with that, our training includes diagnosing, treating, and prescribing medications for all avenues of mental illness and physical illness. Prior to 2004, it was at least a general belief that in a case of an emergency, a physician assistant had the ability to be one of the persons involved in a two-physician hold. In 2004, Legacy Emanuel Hospital sent a letter to the Oregon Medical Board asking for a little bit more information in regards to that. The PA committee with the Oregon Medical Board reviewed it and went through both the statutes and the DHS OARs and found that no PAs really are not listed anyplace. And so their conclusion at that time is no PAs really cannot do that. So their response back to Legacy Emanuel was, no, you shouldn't have not be doing that because you're not listed any place as far as a practitioner that has that ability. And it may have been oversight. As a PA, we are still fairly new in the state. We are still a small organization, but more PAs are graduating, more PAs are practicing, and as we see Oregon Health Plan changing and what comes out with House Bill 2009, we're going to see a lot of changes both with increased patient care and with our needs to provide that care. So what determined at that point that we needed to be able to move forward and get involved with that, and that was going to be through one of two avenues. That was going to be either through a statutory change or through an OAR change with DHS. Talking with DHS and Dr. Goldberg, it was right now they are a little overwhelmed, and it was going to be quite a while before they really felt like this was something that they were going to be able to bring up as a major OAR change with everything else going on. And so he said, you know, talk with them about a statutory change, and that's what brought this bill. First part was we came with the concept that this is what we want to do, and unfortunately LC came out with the very large 11-575, and as we discussed with it as a group and got input from other parties, we found that, no, really what we're looking for is a two-physician hold. And that's where we brought it down to section number 7. I'll give you one antidote as far as a urban area. This is obviously very much in a rural. In 1998, I actually work in orthopedics. You wouldn't think orthopedics is a place that I would be doing a lot of two-physician hold, but I had one occasion where I did do that prior to the 2004 change. And I was a PA in a group of 20 physicians and 5 PAs at Emmanuel Hospital, orthopedic practice. And in the office at that time, I was the only provider in that office. I was doing a post-operative check on a patient who had an on-the-job injury and was involved in a deboning injury on where he was a fisherman and worked in a fishing plant and got pulled into a deboning machine. So he had amputations of bilateral extremities. When I saw him for his follow-up, he came in with his friend, and his friend pulled me to the side and said, "I'm very concerned. He lives on the coast. They recently had moved there just prior to his injury. He has left his family right now. He received an initial settlement from SAFE. He went out and bought a Trans Am. We spent the night underneath the bridge drinking all night, and his statement to me is that he's going to drive the Trans Am off a cliff today after this visit." And so being the only provider there, not knowing the OMB's direction, I called his attending physician who was in surgery, explained the situation to him, and said, "I'm willing to be one of the two of a physician hold so I can get security up here," because he's unwilling to go down and meet with a psychiatrist, go to the emergency room in a crisis situation. He had been taking antidepressant medications prior to this, but he had stopped taking those medications. That physician agreed with me. So we had security at Emmanuel come up. They brought him down to the emergency room. Psychiatrist that was on call was consulted. They talked with his psychologist and psychiatrist that had originally been treating him and were able to get him back on his medications. They did hold him overnight and got him back into his system that he was originally in. The good resolve is that 6 weeks later, I saw him for another visit. So he came back. He was very angry, swearing at me that day, came back very appreciative after that. So I think this is just not a rural, but it's also an urban problem, and it's an area where, as a PA, we are at times going to be the only provider that's in the clinic at that moment. And since we are already treating these individuals, and even though I was treating an orthopedic problem, there was also a mental ill emergency that was occurring right at that same time. I recognized that and said we needed to start to take action on treating that. And that's what this bill would do. Thank you.
One more proponent for the bill, and then Pat Kennymore.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Kennymore. I'm here representing Oregon Society of Physician Assistants today, but I also wear another hat, and that is as an associate professor and academic coordinator of the Physician Assistant Program at Oregon Health and Science University, something that I have done since the program's inception approximately 14 years ago. I'd like to tell you just a bit about the educational background of PAs as it relates to mental health issues. We are very broadly based in our training and have a generalist training that allows us to work in all different specialties of medicine, including mental health services and psychiatry. Currently, our educational process for PAs is broken down into approximately 2 years. The first year is primarily didactic in nature, and within that time frame, students receive approximately 175 hours worth of direct instruction on mental health and behavioral health issues. During the second year of the program, students have a series of clinical rotations, much like what a third or fourth year medical student would do, and they ultimately end up with over 2,000 hours of directly observed clinical practice with patients under the guidance of physicians. By the time they graduate, they've had over 75 hours of direct education and experience in the use, appropriate use of pharmacotherapy, including many of the psychiatric medications. After graduation, we all take a national certifying exam, which is required for state licensure, and as has been mentioned, we are all licensed by each of the state's medical boards in whatever form they may be. PAs are required to do 100 hours of continuing medical education every 2 years, which is one of the strictest requirements of all healthcare providers out there. And we must recertify in a generalist exam every 6 years. Again, something very broad, even as Mr. Byer mentioned, someone working in orthopedics still would be required to take an exam on issues that cover such topics as psychiatry. So we remain very generalist in our education. I wanted to let you know this because there are many PAs that do work in a variety of different specialties, and I believe we're all well trained to provide that care. And in this particular situation, what we're asking for is the opportunity to assist in emergency care of our psychiatric patients to get them to mental health providers who can provide them with long-term care if that's what they need, or short-term intervention. I'd be happy to answer any questions about PA education either at OHSU or from the profession as a whole. Thank you for your time.
Have you brought this issue to the Oregon Medical Board?
I have not personally brought it to the medical board, so I'm not the right person to answer that question. I apologize.
I can answer that. The OMA has looked this over, and they are on board with us. They agree that it is an extension of what we're already doing.
But the Board of Medical Examiners, I think it's called the board.
The OMA is the Oregon Medical Society. Mm-hmm. The OMB thought initially that Senate bill that we first brought was a little broad and had some concerns, and they are also willing to look at it, the Dash 1 amendments, as an extension of what we do.
And I think, as you know, in the interim, scope of practice is not an issue that we love to deal with here in the legislature. So in the interim, we had the lobby get together and set up guidelines that anyone who wanted a scope would need to meet those guidelines. And I've already talked to Mr. Koba about that. And before I am comfortable moving any bill, is that those guidelines are followed explicitly and then come forward with that. And I don't know if you want to respond to that or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marshall Koba with the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Yesterday we had this Dash 1 amendment drafted, and prior to that, late in last week, we were talking to some of you and some of the other folks interested in the issue, and we actually have this filled out as of yesterday afternoon, and I will be happy to share that with the committee and staff at the appropriate time. Now that we're moving forward, I just wanted to make sure that we're moving forward with the Dash 1 amendments, and we will comply with the scope guideline.
And that means we do need to have the opposition. Actually, we need to have the Oregon Medical Board and the association following the guidelines also with their responses. Okay. All right. Any questions for them? Okay.
Just one on the Dash 1s. If you go down to line 9, it mentions page 10, line 29. I believe it should be page 9, line 29.
On what?
On the Dash 1 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Just a slight correction. It mentions on line 9 of the Dash 1 amendments, it says page 10, line 29. I think it should be page 9, line 29.
Okay.
Just a small detail.
All right. Any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yeah.
If we find the Dash 1s acceptable and they go through the process you're considering, they're going through with you, considering the time we have left in this session to pass bills out, is it your intention to try to work this bill in the future?
I need to see the guidelines. And we need to hear from the medical board, and we need to hear from the Oregon Medical Association. All of those are issues that need to be dealt with. And at this point, they have not signed up to testify, but we have others that are here to testify. But no, I don't tend to move it until I see that the guidelines have been followed.
May I should rephrase that. Is it your intention to possibly, in this session, move this bill?
If it's up to the committee.
Thank you. And the reason I'm asking that is when I read the bill, and it's kind of complex, but it was to me sort of an oops to a certain degree. I'm like, this isn't okay to do already, because I know what's going on.
It is going on.
And so it's kind of dicey.
And we would like to, Senator Bates and Madam Chair, we would, when it goes on, it's in an emergency situation, and it's life and death, and it shouldn't come down to a life, a person's life, a mentally handicapped person's life. And it's when it happens, as Scott said, in the urban areas before 2004, it was an okay thing. Now it isn't, and in places like Condon and Fossil, it does happen, and we shouldn't have to be providing good care in and going against the legalities of our state.
Ma'am?
Yes?
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
The other part of this, though, is that the chair, through a lot of very good work in the interim, has set up a process to go through on these issues, because it gets very contentious sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes turf wars and whatnot involved. And that process really does need to be followed. I think she's done a great job in doing that, and it's been a real service to us all that process has been set up. So it's kind of a statement to others. You need to go through the process.
Senator Bates, I understand that. And we are in the middle of that process. And like I said, the OMA is on board. The OMB had some questions about the original. And with the Dash Amendment just being done yesterday, that's in process also, and it looks favorable. But we can bring those to you.
And I think you'll hear testimony, too, after you're finished. You will need to bring those stakeholders on board also.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, I'll call John McCauley from the Oregon Psychiatry Association, and Bob Jundeff, and Andrea.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley. I'm with the Oregon Psychiatric Association, here to speak on Senate Bill 575. We clearly understand the issues involved in this bill and have often had disagreements with others here at this table with me, because we would like to see better ways to treat people who are in these circumstances. And so we have several sessions ago brought bills forward to loosen the restrictions on the ability to treat people in these situations. At the same time, we were concerned as we first saw Senate Bill 575 that it looked like the physician assistant, as was specified in the bill, could act independently and not in conjunction with the supervising physician. We are pleased to see the Dash 1 amendments. We think that is a great improvement in the bill. We would further like to see a clarification that says that the physician assistant, this may be a belt and suspenders issue, but would like to see clarification that the physician assistant acting in this capacity is doing so under the agreement or supervision with the supervising physician.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and we advocate on behalf of people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. And I'm here today to speak from the perspective of people with mental illness who may come into contact with the civil commitment process. And from the perspective of their rights, we, as you know, we have a civil commitment process in Oregon, and what that process does is that it allows trained medical personnel to take people into custody in a hospital situation because the professional has made a determination that the person is suffering from some sort of mental illness, and that has rendered them, or at least arguably rendered them, dangerous to themselves or others. And of course, that's a profound power because that professional was given the power and responsibility to take away a person's freedom at least for a short period of time. And when that happens, just very quickly, a process gets initiated in which someone is notified, the community mental health center in the county is notified, and someone comes out from that center to review the situation to make a determination of whether that person needs to have a court hearing. And that has to all happen in 5 judicial days, 5 court days. And if that person decides a hearing needs to go forward, then that can happen. And this can result in the person being placed in a state hospital for up to 6 months as a result of a finding by the court. So what we're talking about here is an initial authority to take a person into custody, in effect, even though that person hasn't committed a crime. The person is being taken into custody for their own good and for their safety. And we have placed that responsibility with trained medical personnel. So right now we've limited the authority to do that to doctors. And in fact, one doctor can't do it themselves. The doctor has to have a second doctor or qualified mental health professional, someone who's been trained to understand how mental health issues affect people, to make that call. So we treat this seriously. We have 2 people who need to do that. Now, one of the things we also do in the law is that we give all of the people who participate in this, who make the decision to hold the person against their will, we give them good faith immunity from liability. So what the law says is, so when we're going to give you this power, we want you to exercise your judgment well, and if you do so, no one can sue you. No one can charge you with a crime for having done that. So this is a pretty significant thing that we hand over to physicians. And I think from the perspective of people with mental illness who go into crisis, who sometimes come to the emergency room seeking help, that having this type of authority exerted upon them is very significant, and they don't treat it lightly, and they hope no one else treats it lightly. And we know these can be life and death situations, so it's very important for the judgment to be done well. That brings us to Senate Bill 575. When we looked at this bill originally, what it seems to do is say on its face that physician's assistants can exercise all the same powers as a physician. And have the same immunities for acting as a physician, in the same manner as a physician. One is then has to say, well, what is the scope of that authority? Or does this person now get to act independently of other doctors, of doctors, and now have a whole new authority that's been created by statute? So looking to ORS 677-515, which is the statute that authorizes physicians' assistants to act as licensed professionals, that law says that a physician assistant can operate in Oregon if they have the proper education, if their services rendered are, quote, under the supervision and control of a person licensed to practice medicine in Oregon, and the use of those services have been approved by the Oregon Medical Board. So there are brackets around the scope of practice of a physician assistant. So when we go and look at that, there's a question. In our mind, what this bill is trying to get at, and in talking to the proponents, I think we've confirmed that, is that they would like the scope of practice that's set forth in 677-515 to include the ability to place mental health holds. And As such, as long as that's under the true supervision and control of a licensed physician, there are some protections there, and there's some liability that flows back to the physician to assure that there's proper supervision and that this person has the training and has specifically been authorized to conduct this type of medical decision. However, on the bill, on the face of the bill, it seems to just place, say, a physician can do this and a physician's assistant can do that. And that gives us some concern. It just seems to broaden out the whole scope of authority to another professional group without any limits on it. And as such, we feel that it, what our concern again is that, of course, if you're in a situation in a rural clinic where a person's life is at stake and you can't call the police, which is an alternative to taking control of somebody that the law allows, if a person really has to act in those situations, of course, that seems prudent. What we are concerned about is a hospital saying, gee, physician's assistants are less expensive than doctors are, and we can kind of make this more efficient and less costly by moving another paraprofessional, if you will. I don't know if that's a fair term, and I don't want to diminish their training and abilities, but into these positions and to give them complete protection from liability for the decisions they make, and that would give us some concern. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Andrea, and then Megan McCauley.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU, here also to express some concerns about Senate Bill 575, sharing in Mr. June Jeff and Disability Rights Oregon's concern, recognizing the profound power that we give individuals, in some cases non-governmental individuals, the authority to detain and hold someone in custody and remove their liberty rights in situations where it is against their will. And so we will continue to work with DRO and any other stakeholders to ensure that the protections necessary that we believe should be there are there as we have this discussion and other ones in this very difficult area. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Marcel.
Did you include the dash ones in your comments? I don't know that you've read the dash ones.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, yes, I have read the dash ones, and as I understand them, they still provide authority to a physician assistant to take a person into custody in a hospital setting and exercise those authorities. It does cut out some of the additional authorities that are given physicians in the commitment process.
What about the five-day rule? You have 5 days. It just seems to me that it would be not only prudent but humane for a physician assistant to prevent someone from hurting themselves or committing suicide. Right out, you know, I hope you agree with that. It would be inhumane, unethical, immoral, maybe illegal, but unethical and immoral. Now, as I understand the Dash Ones, they would be working with a physician to do that. And secondly, it would be a temporary situation for the protection of the individual. In fact, I could see liability all over the place if someone stood by and watched someone commit suicide in their presence without trying to stop them. So I think some of these objections are ridiculous, absurd, and unreasonable. So I'm hoping that we can get together and understand this and work out the, you know, whatever, unless there are purists who don't want to work out a reasonable compromise, I think that we hopefully can find one.
I think it's important for Mr. Shook to sort of coordinate that meeting with the stakeholders and we also need to have a copy of the guidelines. We also need to, maybe even before you get together, we need to have in writing the medical board as well as the Oregon, the association, medical association's input on this also. All right,
Chairman Sanderson, just briefly, I at least in reading the Dash One amendments, do not see the change in that we've discussed. I still read them as providing separate, distinct authority to the physician assistant to stand in the shoes as one of those independently. So I appreciate there may be disagreements and there may be ultimate disagreements, but please understand from our perspective, at least, we don't see that changed in the version that's before you with the dash ones. And that may have been the intent of the drafters. I appreciate that frustration we all share sometimes.
And I know how frustrating it is, though, when you have someone who's about to commit suicide or is endangering someone else's life. We have to be reacting as quickly as possible, and especially in those situations where you have a physician who disagrees or you have a physician who isn't available. So, yeah, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one question I would have would be, is a physician assistant less qualified to make a determination than a peace officer who can make the determination in law? And so that would be a question. But ultimately for me, and there may be urban settings as well, but I've been to Condon and I've been to Halfway. I had a good friend who used to live there, Patricia Gainsforth. Okay. I knew she would know her because it's a very small community. But and I've been to Granite and I've been to a few of these places where physicians are not available, and so it does become, to a degree, a public safety issue and a personal safety issue for a person who may be episodic, and so there's got to be some way we can make an accommodation here, because it is a safety issue in my opinion, and the ability to not trample on somebody's rights, but to make sure that they don't do something untoward, and which happens all the time, and we know that. So I guess, Madam Chair, from my perspective, if a peace officer with their training has the ability to make a determination, I'd like to know what the difference between their training and a physician assistant is that would make them less qualified.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, of course, if a police officer has the authority to take someone into custody and to transport them to a hospital.
Right.
And has the training, of course, to make the determination of whether that needs to happen on the street. But it is the physician that's given the authority to hold the person, to admit the person into the hospital, and to hold them and to initiate that 5-day process of hold and then the whole civil commitment process. Another thing that happens when that physician makes that determination is that the government is now on the tab to pay for those medical services during that period of time. So there is also sort of a fiscal issue in terms of who makes that call as well. And I think the issue really is that we as a society have decided that decision, that admission to the hospital, the beginning of the civil commitment process, is a medical decision. And we want the medical personnel to be trained to do it. And I think our issue is not so much if we have an individual who's particularly trained and supervised to do that, and that performs a valuable function. We want to get that person who the police officer picks up to that right person to make the evaluation. Do we have a problem with the drug overdose? Do we have a problem with the seizure? Do we have a problem with a developmental disability? Or do we have a mental illness that requires the initiation of medication? I mean, what are we dealing with here? And that's why those sorts of decisions are the reasons we delegate that authority to physicians who are trained to make those calls. If we have another professional who's trained to make those calls or is under the direct supervision of someone who is, I personally don't think that's a problem, because we're getting at what we want to see happen. I think the problem, our concern, is that there may be somebody making those calls who isn't so trained and supervised mm-hmm. to do it.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the exception of Dr. Bates,
I don't like the way that one started.
We're laypersons, and I'm a little uncomfortable in a discussion about making a determination of who's qualified and who isn't qualified. And that's why we have a medical a board of, we used to call it BME, Board of Medical Examiners. Now it's the Medical Board of Oregon.
Oregon Medical Board.
If in fact, these PAs would be required to go through that qualification process through that board, I'm not comfortable second-guessing that function because that's what we've ascribed to them. So if in fact, as it was represented, I think, by Senator Morissette, that is a requirement, then I'm comfortable. But I'm not comfortable sitting here and passing judgment on who's qualified and who isn't. That's not our role, in my judgment, with the exception of the good senator,
Dr.
Bates.
See, it wasn't bad.
It could have been worse.
It has been worse.
Now, we do have one more to testify, and I do want to have Megan Cahey to please come forward.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahey, and I'm here to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 575 on behalf of Mental Health America of Oregon, of which I am the Vice President. Mental Health America of Oregon is an advocacy organization for mental health consumers, and I myself am a mental health consumer, and I myself have known what it's like to be in a hospital emergency department placed on a hold. So this bill has some personal meaning for me. I have some real concerns with this bill. Even with the -1 amendments, I feel like I'm not comfortable with the physician's assistants initiating a hospital hold for persons. I believe that the civil commitment process is a very, very serious event for a person. And I know that when people are in a place where they're feeling like hurting themselves or hurting someone else or not being able to take care of themselves, I know what that's like, but to be in a position where someone can take someone's freedom, I believe that belongs to a physician. It's a medical decision, and I believe we need to be careful not to erode the medical rights of persons with mental illness. One thing that occurred to me during some earlier testimonies was that it seems like it's very quick in some situations that people are moving to put people on holds, or that people are ending up in situations in hospital emergency departments where I would say that we should be focusing on having people getting services in community mental health departments so that people are not ending up in crisis emergency departments. If people had well-funded crisis services in the emergency, in the community mental health setting, and services that kept people away from crisis. Right now we're looking at reforming our community and our entire mental health system. And we need to do things preventatively so that we do not have people needing to go through the commitment process and ultimately end up in our state hospital. That's where this ultimately ends up, is people going to the state hospital, and we need to keep people out of the state hospital through a vibrant community mental health system.
Thank you, Megan.
May I?
Yes, yeah. Please.
Thank you, Megan. As a result of the meeting 2 weeks ago in this room, and I think you might have been here when we had a mental health hearing and we had people from Lane County testifying, we're going to have... we set up a meeting in Lane County to discuss a wide range of these mental health issues, because I believe that it's very important that people who have a history or has some experience are part of the solution, that you weigh in on issues and that you help determine the future. Obviously, that is really important. Really, really, really important. There is one sentence, though, that sounds like you don't completely object. So, I understand that in some rural locations there are a shortage of physicians, and it would be expedient to use a physician assistant to civilly commit someone. Now, what I guess I'm getting at is, would you object to a physician assistant with? Under the direction of a doctor, consulting with a doctor by phone if necessary, to do something to prevent that person from hurting themselves or hurting someone else, at least until there's other care available. I mean, this is an emergency in some rural communities, and they're acting illegally. Technically, they're breaking the law if they restrain someone and hold them. So go ahead.
I would say if the physician would take the responsibility, and so that the physician was taking the liability, the responsibility, and the initiation of the act, but not the physician assistant.
Okay. Okay. So may I? Take the responsibility ultimately, but I mean, if you're in halfway Oregon, you're 50 miles from between heaven and Hell's Canyon, and there is an emergency, and you have to do something to restrain that. Well, I think any citizen would do that, any police officer would do that, until a physician is available. And then it's up to the physician to do the commitment.
Yes.
I think that, at least as a nurse, I've been a nurse on my own in camps. You know, we have summer camps, and I'm the nurse, and I have standing orders, and I follow those standing orders to the T in following. And if there was a standing order, if someone is threatening, there would be a standing order for me. And I don't know how it works for physician's assistants. If they have standing orders, they do not. Okay, Senator Bates.
I'll just make a couple comments, and then I'll wait and see what the dash amendments look like and what other people have to say. But this is something that physicians take very seriously. I do this probably once a year, maybe twice a year in my practice. We are very careful with it, very thoughtful about it. We just don't walk out willy-nilly and sign off on what used to be a 72-hour two-doctor, not commitment, but hold. We don't do commitments this way. These are holds for people who are a danger to themselves or others. We have extended that now really to more like 5 judicial days, because we sometimes, during a 72-hour period of time, can't get to the courts, can't get somebody from mental health in to review the case that quickly. But these are holds. There's not commitments. Having said that, as I read the bill as it stands, and I haven't seen the Dash 1's amendments, I think we do need some careful sideboards here. We need to be able to protect people in situations where a physician is not readily available, and protect those people or protect society. This is not just for themselves, but for others also. You can find yourself with a very angry patient who has something wrong. It may be a mental health condition. It may be a drug condition. I've had cases where it was an elderly patient who had a urinary tract infection, and they get demented from that, amazingly. And you give them an antibiotic, and 24 hours later, they're fine again. I mean, you need that kind of expertise on board to make these decisions. So it gets very tricky sometimes. Having said that, what concerns me still about the bill is the relationship between a PA and a physician, how tight that is for making this kind of decision needs to be spelled out pretty carefully. And I'm not certain the way the bill reads that a PA and another PA couldn't get together and do a five-day hold. I'd be concerned about that. There should be at least one physician directly involved in the case, along with the PA working under the care of or under the directions of another physician. I didn't see that in the bill. I don't know if it's in the Dash 1 amendments or not, but it needs to be in there if it isn't. So there's one physician directly involved, and then a PA from another physician assisting in this. I think if they did those kinds of things, this would be something that would work for everybody. Work for the patient, work for society, work in those, especially those rural situations, or it's 3 o'clock in the morning, it's Legacy Hospital, you've got an ER patient in front of you, you can't get a hold of that second physician. I can see it happening, working that way, that would work for everybody. But people need to come together on this. And deal with it. I think in the way I've outlined it is probably appropriate. I'm getting some nods out there. I'm not sure from everybody. But we should be able to put sideboards on this that'll work and make what's happening legal and maybe even improve what's going on. There's two other people I like to see involved in this besides the ones that have been mentioned. One is Dr. Chuck Kaufman in Ontario. Dr. Kaufman is thoughtful. I'm sure he's been in this position sometimes, and I would expect he'd be helpful. The other one I'd like to see involved is Dr. Norwood Knight-Richardson, psychiatrist at OHSU, who works with telemedicine in rural areas, and usually has pretty strong views on this, and is very careful about commitments, and is on PSRB. So he would be someone I'd like to have opinions from both of those and suggestions of how we could move this forward. And we've got a time limit.
We do.
This is going to have to happen pretty quickly to get this bill through.
But what we do want to address is what is in the best interest of the patient, and we want to do it right. So thank you very much, and colleagues, we still need. I think Marshall has his marching orders, and he will get back with us, and then Mr. Shook can coordinate a meeting with everybody if we can get some sense of consensus. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 575, and we've carried a number of bills over. We just got the amendments for Senate Bill 18, so will you make sure that Jeff Hetherington and the Hospital Association gets a copy of those, and then maybe we did carry the bill over, so we may be able to do that. Did I close? Yeah, I think I closed 575. And we are adjourned.